The news is alarming, and the repeated occurrence makes it that much more concerning. UN war crime investigators have expressed concern over the rising civilian deaths in Syria due to the intensified U.S.-led airstrikes. In this edition of the debate, we'll look at why the U.S. claims civilian deaths are avoided in its air raids in Syria, yet locals and international organizations say most of those killed are civilians. Well, guests joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from Washington. We have Richard Millett, a journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. I'm going to first start with you, Richard Millett, and get your reaction on what the special investigator has said from the UN. And I'm going to be quoting him. Staggering loss of civilian lives has happened because of the intensified coalition airstrikes supporting an assault by U.S.-backed forces on Daesh stronghold of Raqqa in Syria. Why is that happening? Why is the U.S.-backed forces responsible for this staggering loss of civilian life, as the UN war crimes investigator has said?
Well, we don't know yet whether it is a staggering loss of civilian life. The UN is operating outside Syria. These are all witness statements. Now, any loss of even one life is horrific, but set against the actual size of civilian loss of life, which really is staggering in Syria, we're talking about 500,000 dead because the brutal Syrian dictator Assad, who has never been properly elected by his own people, is still in situ in Syria. If he had fled the scene like he should have done, then there could have been, for example, a unification of Syria and all concentration focused on fighting Daesh. Instead, Iran has supported Assad. It's wanting to take control of Syria with a view to creating a corridor so it can supply Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, with obviously a view to hitting Israel. This is the main problem in the region: Iran's support for the brutal dictator Assad, who has now killed up to 500,000 of his own people. And it's also come back to hit Iran, obviously, because now we've had Islamic State Daesh terrorist attacks in Tehran itself. This is a brutal group, ISIS, that is now spreading outside Syria, as we've seen in the recent attacks in the United Kingdom as well, and in Tehran. So, yes, this has been a tragic loss of life, if it is true, but remember that Daesh also are holding it, so the civilians in Raqqa as hostages, just like Hamas have done in Gaza to the Palestinian people in Gaza. Raqqa are holding its own people, the Syrian people, hostage in Raqqa, hoping that there are these kinds of possible losses, if it's true, so then they can be blamed on the West.
I think I got four topics for our next few debates out of the statements that you just said there, but one of them is very concerning, and that is the fact that you are, I think, implying that Iran and the terrorist attack that happened that resulted in the death of 17 people is something that it deserved because it's engaged in Syria. Am I correct in understanding you that way, Richard Millett?
No, nothing's deserved. It's tragic that anything is happening. It's happening in London. It's happening
in Tehran.
Very good.
I just want to make sure that was clear. It's been happening because that needed to be addressed. Okay, so you heard our guest there, Brian Becker. Go ahead if you have a response to him.
Mr. Miller's view is based on, well, I would say a fantasy, a right-wing fantasy, but it's really not. It's just the tried and true propaganda of the U.S. and NATO war makers who have fragmented Syria just as they fragmented Iraq, just as they fragmented Libya by their imperialist interventions, occupations, bombing campaigns. Mr. Miller doesn't actually care about dead people in Syria because he didn't address your original question, which was the civilians who are dying in very large numbers as a consequence of U.S. airstrikes, and that's not a report from the Assad government. Those are international observers who are documenting the fact that U.S. Airstrikes that are intensifying in Raqqa and around Raqqa are killing a lot of civilians, just as they killed many, many hundreds in Mosul. And of course, thousands of civilians have been killed as the U.S. engages in drone strikes, arrogating to itself the idea that it can decide who to bomb, what countries to bomb, and it bombs many countries constantly. The 500,000 people dead in Syria were not killed by Assad. 125,000 of those dead are members of the Syrian Arab Army, a majority Sunni army, which has been fighting al-Qaeda, been fighting the al-Nusra Front, fighting the terrorists backed by the United States, and fighting ISIS. If Assad had fled as Mr. Miller wanted him to flee in 2011 and 2012, ISIS would be in Damascus right now. Or maybe it would be al-Qaeda. It would be one of these right-wing extremist terrorist organizations. Mr. Assad represents a secular government. You may not agree with its policies, but nonetheless, there are policies that have protected religious minorities rather than chop their heads off. They have protected the rights of women rather than driving women back to the 7th century. In other words, in many social questions, the Assad government is far superior to anything that would have taken its place in 2011 and 2012. The fact that the Syrian Arab Army and the Syrian government held on, the fact that the army, again, a majority Sunni military, because the country is majority Sunni, remained intact and was able to defend itself, and the fact that it has allies, both Iran and Russia, helping to keep the country together against these terrorists, that's all to the good, not because war is good, the war is terrible, but because the outcome for Syria would be like the outcome in Libya. In other words, the takeover of the country by extremist terrorist organizations that Mr. Miller would actually be perfectly satisfied with supporting, although he may criticize them. He prefers them to the Assad government, obviously.
Well, we're looking at something that has occurred here, and I'd like to find out from you, Richard Millett, going beyond, obviously, the views that you have of Assad and how he is somehow responsible for the U.S. and the U.S.-led airstrikes. I'm not too sure how that justifies the loss of civilian lives. But here you have this U.S. Central Command, even CENTCOM, admitting that 484 civilian deaths have happened up to the end of April as a result of coalition strikes. That's nearly 60% of civilian deaths from the three-year military campaign to have been reported this year, but to have happened during that time frame. And that's since Trump came into power. So has there been a change of tactic? Is there a something that has instigated this rise in civilian deaths? Because it's not as it was before. And since Trump has come, it has increased dramatically.
So it's quite remarkable here. 500,000 people have died in Syria as a result of this civil war, as a result of Iran propping up Assad in power. And yes, civilians have been killed. This is what we see time and time again when Daesh hold civilian populations, hide behind civilian populations, hide in the houses of those civilians. So obviously, in the attempt to remove Daesh, there is going to be a tragic loss of civilian life. We don't know the exact numbers. Even one civilian loss is a tragedy. But this is a fact of war when you're trying to free a population from the brutality of Daesh, which is controlling it. And Iran has got to put its hand up and say that by being part of the civil war, allowing Assad to destroy his opposition, then that has allowed Daesh to get into the Syrian population and take over the cities. And unfortunately, to release and free those Syrian cities, there is inevitably going to be some loss of civilian life. Blame it on the West, of course. That is what certain groups will always want to do. Blame everything on America, blame everything on Israel, and praise Assad. We even heard from Mr. Becker his admission that Syria is a Sunni majority country. So therefore, we can see the oppression of Assad, who is not a Sunni, who is an Alawite. And whenever there's oppression, there's massacre by Assad, whether it's him or by his father in 1982, you'll recall, Hamer. Up to 25,000 Sunni Syrians were murdered by Assad's father. It's historical and it's present.
Got it. Brian Becker, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Miller wants to see all of the world through the Sunni-Shiite schism, apparently. In other words, just like some people in the United States would say, well, if Barack Obama is the president of the United States and he's African-American and only 13% of the population is African-American, that means white people must be oppressed in the United States simply by virtue of the fact that someone from a minority became the leader of the state. The fact of the matter is that we don't want to look at the world like that. We don't want to look at the world based on ethnocentric decisions and ethnic cleansing that follows from it. The fact that the a minority population, the Alawites, also are the ruling group inside of Syria does not mean that Sunnis are inherently oppressed. In fact, if the Sunni, if the Syrian Arab Army, which again is majority Sunni, had felt oppressed by Assad, they has ample ability to rise up against Assad, but they've remained largely intact. You have the same sort of racist, stereotypical caricaturing of Eastern countries as if people in the East, not in the West, not in the United States, not in Britain, not in France, but they must be determined, and their leadership must be determined by religious and ethno-sectarian considerations rather than national identity. The Assad government, like other progressive or semi-progressive governments over the years after the colonial era in which the French and the British super oppressed the people in the region, Sunni and Shiite alike, and all the ethnicities there, afterwards it developed a national identity, a pan-Arabist identity. As a consequence, it was trying to overcome the divisions that allowed colonial powers to splinter the country. The United States, when it came back to Iraq in 2003 with the shock and awe invasion, and even before that, after the 1991 war, always determined that there would be a Kurdish militias and Shiite militias and Sunni militias, and used that as a way to fragment a country that had achieved national unity after the ravages of colonialism. Mr. Miller wants to go back to the colonial era where the British developed the divide and conquer strategy. They employed it in South Asia between dividing Pakistanis and Muslims and Hindus. We reject that kind of an idea, and the idea that because a minority person happens to be the head of state that means the majority must be oppressed. That's just wrong.
Well, we're trying to focus in on some of the main topics here, Richard Miller, and that is, and we keep going off track somewhat. I'm looking at the different instances that the U.S. has been involved, along with the U.S.-led coalition now in Syria and in Iraq. These reports obviously are official reports, and by some estimates, it is said that the number of civilian casualties is much higher. But at the same time that this report came out of the U.S. civilian casualties, there's been another report that the anti-Daesh U.S. coalition is using white phosphorus both in Iraq and Syria. I mean, white phosphorus is an internationally banned weapon. It does cause severe injuries. It burns through the skin. And it's very reminiscent of what happened to the Gaza Strip with Israel attacking the Gaza Strip. Do you think that it's okay for the U.S. and the coalition to be using white phosphorus?
Well, first of all, going back to what Mr. Becker said, that remember Obama was democratically elected. This brutal dictator, he's a dictator. He hasn't been democratically elected. He seems to achieve 99% of the voting of the population, which is hilarious. So white phosphorus isn't internationally banned. It's allowed in the field of war. We have to see afterwards how it was employed. Israel was criticized, but these are white phosphorus is used with a view not to injure or maim. As I understand it, there has been no indication that anyone has actually been injured by the use of white phosphorus over Raqqa. It's just used as a smoke screen, indicator, as a way to light up the way. But as I understand, no one has as yet being injured in Raqqa. Yes, it's quite right to be critical of it and say it shouldn't be used. But if you want to accuse America of war crime, then you have to wait and see afterwards as to what the intent, the actual intent of the use of white phosphorus is. If it was used incorrectly, then there's a possibility of war crime. If the intent was not with a view to A, to maim or injure, then it's not a war crime and it's legal to use it on the battlefield.
Well, that's one of the question marks, Brian Becker. The rising civilian casualties is happening at such an occurrence and it's getting repeated so often. There's some that are questioning whether there is an intent by the Saudi-led coalition to actually incur casualties. That's in some, by some camps, maybe they say that's far-fetched. But why is this occurring so much? Based on some reports, these bombs that are being used by the U.S., they should be precision-guided bombs. So why are there these civilian casualties?
Well, there's a lot to unpack with your question. Would the United States government actually try to harm civilians? The answer to that question is yes. I mean, the U.S. employed economic sanctions against Iraq for 13 years. Every month, according to the UN, 8,000 people died, 5,000 children under the age of five, and 3,000 of their grandparents, the youngest, the oldest, the most vulnerable, died because of the absence of food or medicine. So from the point of view of intent, the obvious intent of the economic sanctions was to punish an entire people with the hope that that people would then rise up against a government that the United States wanted to overthrow. That was the Saddam Hussein government. The U.S. bombed the infrastructure, the water system, the electrical grid, all of those things in Baghdad were designed to harm civilians. And the United States, according to much testimony, including independent video brought from Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, the U.S. was doing one-tap, two-tap, three-tap hits on civilian targets in Iraq. So yes, the United States does this. It does harm civilians. But the question here about whether the inordinate rise in civilian casualties is a deliberate thing in Mosul and Raqqa, it doesn't need to be in order to qualify as a war crime. I think the United States is pursuing a policy of very loose rules of engagement. It's shoot first, ask questions later. The American people are being sort of immunized from the horrors of the war because they're not sending large numbers of boots on the ground. All the bleeding, all the dying is done on the other side. So the U.S. doesn't really care. And as we about whether there are a lot of civilian deaths, and that's a violation of the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions instructs war makers that they must take every precaution to shield and protect civilians, even if those civilians are close to enemy combatants. That's part of the Geneva Convention. During the Vietnam War, and this is my final point, the United States engaged in what was called the daily body count. As a teenager, I woke up and read the body count. 100 Viet Cong were killed today. 80 Viet Cong were killed yesterday. 75 were killed the day before. Except the United States labeled every death as a Viet Cong, as a communist, as what they called as a terrorist. So all deaths were lumped together, thus exempting the United States government from any criteria of whether they were killing civilians or not. And we know after the fact from the Pentagon Papers that a million civilians were killed in Vietnam, and the U.S. didn't really care.
Well, I'm going to give you 30 seconds, Mr. Millett. You have $100 billion worth of arms sales. I think it was paid with $300 billion for the next 10 years, $300 billion plus, that Trump sealed the deal with Saudi Arabia. With that type of weapons coming in, with the U.S. selling it, don't you think that kind of sale would lead to civilian lives in this region?
I think Saudi Arabia isn't using that kind of weaponry against the Syrian, against Daesh. I mean, Daesh is causing enough havoc, and there's been a civil war there between Assad. You know, we're talking about, you know, how many more people do you want to lose their life in Syria? I mean, you want to blame it on Saudi Arabia now. I mean, Saudi Arabia maybe have contributed partly to the rebels, but I don't know what your accusation is here, but we're talking about
it's part of that
brutal dictator propped up by Iran.
It's part of that coalition. Brian Becker, 30 seconds to you. That much weapon sale into the region becoming awash with more weapons, wouldn't that lead to civilian casualties with Saudi Arabia being one of the point men in the Saudi-led coalition?
Well, the Saudis have been funding ISIS. The Saudis have also been funding Al-Qaeda. The Saudis are waging a war against the people and the civilian population in Yemen. President Obama sold $110 billion of weapons to Saudi Arabia during 8 years. Donald Trump says he's offering $110 billion more to the Saudis over the next few years. The $510 million package passed the Senate last week. Yes, the flooding of the region with weapons leads to war. It incentivizes war.
I unfortunately have to jump, and I do apologize. Yes. We're just fresh out of time. Brian Becker, thank you very much from the Answer Coalition. Richard Millett, thank you, journalist and political commentator. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. For me, Kavitha Wynn, the entire team in the Capitol, Tehran, it's goodbye.